Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll hear argument first in the case of the United States against Swift. Mr. Breckenridge.
May it please the court, I would like to talk to you today regarding the illegal second Terry stop issue, and then Professor Godfrey would like to speak to you regarding the jury issue and Mr. Taylor's standing. An issue of fact highly relevant to the issue of the second Terry stop still exists in this case that has not been decided by the trial court, and therefore this case should be remanded to the district court so that the district court may hear argument on this issue and may hear the facts and determine factually what exactly happened during that second Terry stop and to start that second Terry stop. In analysis of this issue, two questions essentially must be answered. First of all, whether an issue of fact really exists. And then second of all, whether that issue of fact...
You're of course assuming that this question is open. Now, Judge Miller said it was the law of the case. It was just covered by our prior opinion. And if your client didn't like our prior opinion and thought that there was a second stop, there should have been a petition for rehearing. So why is this an open question in the case?
Well, there are two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, there is no indication that this court actually decided that issue in the first.
It's often the case that we do not discuss everything that's possible. And, of course, if there's something important that we should have discussed and didn't, that's the office of a petition for rehearing. But the problem I have with your position is that it amounts to saying, well, after you lose in the Court of Appeals the first time, let's go back and try something new. But usually an issue resolved in the Court of Appeals is just resolved.
Well, you're right, Your Honor. But the issue that was resolved in this court in the first case was the issue of the illegal arrest. And the counsel for the appellant in this case in the district court before the first appeal did bring this issue of the second Terry stop. But the district court specifically decided not to decide those issues of fact because it's suppressed on other grounds. Therefore, the issue wasn't even ripe for this court to hear it because no decision of fact had ever been made. Because no decision of fact had ever been made, this court apparently, I realize that you three are the best judges of the issue of whether or not you decided this issue. However, since the opinion didn't mention the issue and because it wasn't really ripe for this court to really review it, then it would appear that this issue was not reviewed before. But even if this issue were reviewed before, then it still should not be the law of the case because under the facts that this court reviewed, we had a weighing of facts where it was the word of the appellants versus the word of an officer of the law, which would be a weighing factor for the court in most cases weigh in favor of the officer of the law. However, after the first appeal, the officer changed his testimony. Officer Hurley changed his testimony from saying that he unequivocally did not allow them back into the Jeep to, well, maybe I did allow them back into the Jeep.
But even if he did, I mean, this may be a slightly different way of making the point Judge Easterbrook was making. When you read our former opinion as a whole, it's very hard to come to the conclusion that it doesn't say in this very compressed time period from a little bit before 10 o'clock in the morning until about 10:25, it wasn't just one continuous thing. Whether somebody gets back into a car and starts to leave where they don't, I mean, it really never ends. And if that's what we held, rightly or wrongly, it is there in the case. You would have to overcome that.
Well, the way I read the case, it determined that there was a generally fluid situation as per the arrest itself. However, since this court didn't actually look into the issue of the second Terry stop, then what we have is a line drawing issue as to whether or not it was fluid or not, or what begins a second Terry stop.
Well, you're right that there's no paragraph in the opinion that says, was there one Terry stop or were there two Terry stops? Certainly not. But what the opinion does say, and of course we have also the person who authored the opinion here with us, but it basically, among other things, says it didn't really make too much difference where Captain Sherbin was. And so I'm just, when you read it as a whole, as I say, it looks to me like it's addressing this as a continuous fact and not this, it's not like there's a Terry stop at 10 o'clock the night before and then the next day at 3 o'clock there's another one. That's easy to see, two Terry stops. This is you practically need a stopwatch to make the argument you're making.
Well, right. That's what I was getting at when I was talking about the issue of line drawing, is that we have to draw the line at the question is, where do we draw the line? Now, if we look at the cases that have covered this issue in other circuits, there are three other circuits that have covered this issue. Now, they drew the line. They didn't have to draw any lines because in those cases, someone was 30 miles down the road or on another flight. And so, but the logical place to draw the line would be to draw it where the person forms a reasonable belief that he or she is no longer subject to a Terry stop and is free to leave, because that's when a Terry stop begins. Under Mendenhall, a Terry stop begins when someone believes that he is not reasonably, has a reasonable belief that he is not free to leave the scene. And so therefore, it only makes logical sense that when the person has a reasonable belief that he is allowed to leave, that the Terry stop has ended. And to draw the line anywhere else would cause a lot of confusion, I believe, in that do you draw the line 5 miles down the line or 5 feet or 5 minutes? But when you set the line at where a reasonable belief is formed, it's a very clear signal to not only the district courts but also to the police officers to let them know where they need to where they need to draw the line as far as whether or not to restop someone, which according to the 10th, 8th, and 5th circuits, in order to restop someone, you must have new articulable facts forming a new reasonable suspicion.
And they do have new facts, in fact, here, because Captain Sherbin has recognized the names and has made the link to other robberies. So I'm not even sure if we went as far with you as to say there were two stops, you wouldn't be meeting these other standards.
Well, in a way, that Captain Sherbin radioing that in could be considered new facts. However, Officer Hurley, maybe it wasn't Officer Hurley, but one of the other officers at the scene also recognized them from that previous robbery issue. So that's not inherently a new fact. And even if it is, it really should be a matter for the district court to determine whether or not that is enough of a new fact to warrant a secondary stop. Because as Dean Garcia, Your Honor?
I gather we are having trouble with the lights, but if you want to leave any time for Mr. Godfrey, this might be a good time to yield to it.
Okay, well, I'll just wrap up very quickly in saying that
I think now would be a good time for you to yield.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Your Honor, Mr. Taylor has 2 points. First, contrary to the government's assertion, Mr. Taylor has standing to contest the suppression issue. And second, both Mr. Taylor and Mr. Swift had a deprivation of their Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. By the way, the jury veneer there was drawn in the Northern District of Indiana. Your Honors, the government contends that Mr. Taylor is without standing to contest the seizure of the evidence from that was eventually seized from the apartment of Mr. Swift's girlfriend. And the police eventually made that nexus through a pager number that was sounded while Mr. Swift was in the custody of the local police. However, Your Honor, this is not a Mr. Taylor's assertion of standing comes from the fact that he was unconstitutionally deprived of his personal liberty when he was summoned out of the red Jeep Cherokee the second time. So this parallels my colleague's argument that the standing, in essence, comes from the second improper Terry stop. And without that stop, the police captain would not have been at the scene. He would not have seen the duct tape. He would not have seen the incriminating headphone evidence. And he would not have seen the keys. There would have been no nexus to the material in the apartment. Second, Your Honors, to the jury veneer question, this is the third time this honorable court has had to face, in a relatively short time span, the fact that the jury veneers that are drawn for the Northern District of Indiana underrepresent African Americans. We have an 11-county area that, pursuant to census data, is approximately 9.8% minority. However, this court has had now three cases since 1999, a total of approximately 120 veneer members, and out of that universe of three cases, there's only been one African American.
But how many cases have been heard by the courts in the Northern District of Indiana, South Bend Division, over that period of time? You would expect, given the size of a jury veneer, that not everyone would even have one necessarily. I suppose in some cases that are some cities like the District of Columbia that's predominantly African-American, you might have jury veneers that don't include any Caucasian people occasionally. Where does it say that every veneer has to have at least one member of every significant minority group? I'll put it that
Your
way.
Honor is, oh, pardon me.
Go ahead.
Your Honor is absolutely right. We have a sampling problem. And nowhere does it require that if your district is 10% that each veneer has to be 10%. However,
or even one. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at. Your theory seems to be that every veneer in the Northern District of Indiana, South Bend Division, has to have at least one member of what I'm trying to say is every significant minority group. I don't mean if there's mm-hmm. some bizarre little, you know, group
right.
of people somewhere, you've got to have one of every one of them. But certainly African Americans are a significant minority group in many parts of our country. Hispanics are as well. And I don't know where that principle comes from if the plan itself, as this one does, starts with a certain set of lists and even says, and if these lists aren't doing the job, you can go back to the judges of the district and they'll look for other lists.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, our argument is not as narrow as that each veneer has to have a certain sampling of underrepresented groups. Our argument is the following, that due to the absolute disparity between the jury veneers that's drawn in the Northern District, because it's primarily dependent on voter rolls, and as pointed in our moving papers, there's compelling evidence that voter rolls traditionally and in this 11-county area underrepresent African Americans.
That's an objection to the jury selection and service plan, which is too late for you to make.
Your Honor, while the
statute requires such objections to be made before trial.
Yes. Your Honor, I realize it's the government's theory that under the statutory...
It's not a theory. That's just the language of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but we are seeking relief under the Sixth Amendment and under the...
Is there any problem under the Sixth Amendment in drawing jury veneers from voter lists?
If it's been shown through some empirical evidence that those veneers underrepresent certain...
Now, Washington against Davis says the Constitution deals only with intentional discrimination, not with disparate impact. So
well,
a claim that you've got disparate impact is no constitutional claim at all.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. If we look to the second prong of the Durin test and the cross-sectional element, and if we also look at what the High Court teaches us from Lockhart, that the cross-sectional element is important because it's very important not to deny the defendant the benefit of the common sense of each portion of the community. It's very important to avoid the appearance of unfairness.
Yes,
and
thank
it's very
you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Hennage.
Good morning. May it please the court. We're asking the court to affirm the convictions of Mr. Swift and Mr. Taylor. With respect to the suppression issue, we've argued in our brief that the law of the case indicates that they have no issue on appeal. Judge Miller was correct in his ruling that this court had determined the constitutionality of the suppression issue. The defendants have not shown any intervening law that would change this court's opinion, nor have they shown that at the trial there was substantially different evidence coming in that might make a difference. With the standing issue of Mr. Taylor.
Would you
Taylor.
Say the same thing if the first stop had been, you know, at 9:30 in the morning and they'd gone off and driven off in the Jeep Cherokee and 30 minutes later Captain Sherbin radioed to the officers, you know, I really think there is a reason to stop these guys, and so they track down the car again now that they know, they of course know now what the whole car looks like, the license plate, and they stop them again? That all
theoretically it could make a difference.
Even if we had ruled the same way before and the district judge had said, I don't have to reach that issue because I'm just suppressing the evidence because I think there's no probable cause for the arrest, which was the posture of the case when we last had it. No decision had been made about whether there was 1, 2, or 20 Terry stops.
With the first Swift opinion?
In your opinion. It was an issue that the district judge had put to the side. He thought it was irrelevant, and indeed it was, based on his view of the suppression finding, but then we reversed on the government's appeal that suppression finding. now they're saying that issue has now become important, even though it was irrelevant before.
Well, we're saying that it's implied in this court's opinion.
Where exactly?
Where the court determined that it didn't matter, that they could have held the defendants at the scene until Captain Sherbin arrived.
This could have held the same thing as did hold? In the actual case that we had, the police retained custody over the defendants from start to finish, right? At the first appeal.
Yes.
As well, far as we
understood it.
They
took them to the station after.
Right, and that counts as retaining custody, I think. Now we're being told that a fact that was not decided before, whether or not, is in fact whether they really did retain custody the whole time. Or was there a 5-minute period in there in which these guys were absolutely free to go? You know, you can imagine the police officer running back down the street saying, come back, or anything.
We're arguing that implicit in this court's ruling, even though the court did not specifically address the second detention issue, that definitely was an issue in the court below, and that if this court had chosen to speak to that issue, it could have, but didn't, because it wasn't important to the overall decision.
But how often do we resolve facts that the district court has chosen not to resolve? Oftentimes, we might reverse the decision on suppression and send it back to the district court saying the reasons you gave for suppressing this evidence were wrong, and you can't suppress it on that ground. But in your view, does that mean that they couldn't suppress it on some other ground never presented before?
Well, if it's implicit in the court's, in the appellate court's ruling, the law of the case would control.
But what if it isn't? What if it's a separate issue? I mean, that's the point of interlocutory appeals. Interlocutory appeals come in the middle of things, and more facts can be developed.
If it's a separate issue that was not addressed by this court's opinion, then yes, the law of the case wouldn't control.
Okay.
Might have been the law of the district court that would control, but not the law of the appellate court. And we would argue that in this court's opinion, this court implicitly held that the second detention question was not material or relevant to the overall question. And then we've argued that even if it had been, that there was not a material change in Officer Hurley's testimony at trial. With the standing issue for Mr. Taylor, we've argued that that standing issue was decided by this court, and there's no intervening law that's been argued that would change that opinion. With respect to the jury selection issue, we've argued that the defendants have failed to meet the second prong of the Duren test. They are basically arguing from their visual observation of their veneer. Clearly, no defendant has the right to have a veneer match, have a fair representation. It's the pool from which those jurors are drawn, which is important. Under the second prong, therefore, they've not shown that there was an underrepresentation that was not fair, not fair and not reasonable, nor have they met the third prong of the Duren test. Their argument kind of mixes up the two prongs. They're indicating that the fact that the juror list in South Bend Division is based on the voter registration list instead of driver's registration list, which might enhance the minority population, is not well taken because they did not make this challenge at the district court. They had the opportunity to make a proper motion under the JSSA. They didn't do that. Had they done that, they would have been able to obtain the information that they would have needed to at least make the argument that there was an underrepresentation of their group, but they didn't do that. They also did not show that there was any improper method in the selection of the jurors past that initial point. There was no allegation made that there was anything improper in the actual selection from the qualified list. So we would argue that they have failed to establish any Sixth Amendment violation in a selection of the jury, and we would ask that the court affirm the convictions. Unless the court would have additional questions, we would rest on our brief.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Breckenridge, your time has expired, but because of the confusion in the lights, we'll be happy to entertain some rebuttal if you have any. So we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Wood hit on the exact issue in this Fourth Amendment argument when she stated that the question then becomes whether or not 30 minutes down the road, whether it would be allowed, and then later talked about whether or not suppression is automatically ruled out by one suppression ruling that is overturned by this court. Overturning one suppression ruling by this court does not mean that the entire area is completely foreclosed for
what
the rest of
the case. To the double jeopardy concerns here when you move to suppress evidence during the trial?
I'm sorry?
When you move to suppress the evidence during the trial, ordinarily suppression issues are resolved once and for all before the trial starts because no jeopardy is attached. The government can't appeal an unfavorable decision. You move to suppress the evidence here during the trial.
Well, I would think
what
that
happens? You waive double jeopardy?
I would believe that you would waive
Did
double
you
jeopardy,
say
Your Honor.
That you waive double jeopardy?
If the court were to have decided to suppress the evidence, and then later on that were overturned, even though it were mid-trial, I would think that the defendants would have waived any claims to double jeopardy by suppressing the evidence mid-trial, and a new trial would have to go forward if a suppression.
I spent many years in the Supreme Court waiting. In the Solicitor General's office, waiting to hear a defendant make a concession like that in the Supreme Court.
Well, it seems only fair to the government that if suppression were denied.
It seemed only fair when I was in the SG's office. Even the defendant's lawyers in Jorn and Sisson and Martin Lennon argued for double jeopardy.
Well, Your Honor, I would have to respectfully disagree with those lawyers. But regarding suppression, that under that issue. They should be granted a new trial if the evidence were then suppressed mid-trial and then removed. I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Breckenridge. Mr. Godfrey, the court appreciates your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and to us. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess before the second case this morning.